Hello and welcome to the How to Exit podcast, where we introduce you to a world of small to medium business acquisitions and mergers. We interview business owners, industry leaders, authors, mentors, and other influencers with the sole intent to share with you what it looks like to buy or sell a business. Let's get rolling. And now a moment for our sponsors. I want to highly recommend you get Acquisition Aficionado magazine. Every month, Acquisition Aficionado magazine brings you tactics for business buying and selling you won't find anywhere else. Learn firsthand from industry leaders who share their success stories, featuring in-depth interviews and stories from leading figures in the business acquisition industry. This multi-platform mobile magazine speaks to acquisition entrepreneurs wherever they are in the journey. And I want you to visit acquisitionaficionado.com today. Hello and welcome to the How to Exit podcast. Today I'm here with Parnell Speed and we're going to talk about all things capital and raising money for your acquisitions. Thank you for being here today, Parnell.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Ronald. Thank you so much for having me.
I always start off with the same joke, man. It's like, hey, you were born and now you ended up on a show about mergers and acquisitions. How in the hell did you end up on this show, man?
What a meandering story. So my background, my corporate background is engineering. And after spending probably 17 or so years in that space, after a couple of rounds of layoffs, I was like, I want to do something different. Got into the real estate game, dabbled in that, I would say. And a few years ago, discovered acquisitions. I met a working at a nonprofit. I met an actual M&A attorney, and I was like, "Well, what do M&A attorneys do?" And started asking questions. And next thing I know, I had an opportunity to go through a training program that allowed me to learn about M&A. And what actually got me into M&A was got excited about doing roll-ups. That was the thing that I really wanted to do, but I really wanted to learn the game, that sort of thing. But back up a little bit in that during that time that I was laid off, I started seeing how difficult it was for people to get access to capital. How difficult it was for me to get access to capital, and started learning about that. And then I helped myself and a few people and they're like, you got to make this a business. Okay. This was kind of like right before COVID. And so about 2019 or so was when I started, and I've just been helping people ever since, you know, get access to, cause there are a lot of sharks out there in this space. Right. So I wanted to be one of those good guys, if you will, that really kind of coaches people along and say, hey, stay away from this kind of money, or this is the best type of money for your particular situation. And so I wanted to carry that into the acquisition space as well, you know, and helping people understand there's lots of money out there for you to do a deal, but what's the right money for you in your particular situation?
So I've been spending a lot of time recently about raising capital, doing private placement memorandums, talking to people who have successfully, interviewing people who have successfully raised capital. I know the space a little bit. Like you, I have a real estate background. So I raised private, you know, I introduced myself to a lot of private investors in that space, and I could raise private capital in small chunks and hundreds of thousands of dollars at a time. So small compared to what we do, you know, what we do and need now. But I'm really curious about this space and all the different avenues there are. When I first got into the space, I even met a guy who was really good at doing loan processing and stuff, and convincing of me and him working together, he went out and figured out how to do, what do they call them? Rural development loans so you'd be surprised at what's considered rural. Like in our town in Tulsa, like Tulsa wouldn't be, but the little town over next to it, which was growing like mad, Owosso was considered rural development. Well, there's businesses there, there's stuff there. So as long as it could have real estate attached to it, you could use these USDA rural development loans, and they're really, really affordable rates and in considerable amounts of money they would loan you. So we were looking at maybe doing assisted living facilities, RALs, and that type of stuff through that. Talk about some of the different loan processes and loan availability, or you call it products that are out there that you're familiar with.
Sure. Well, obviously everybody knows about the king, which is the SBA, right? It's the best money, or not the cheapest money, but it's the hardest to get, right? There's that. And then you have all of the alternative types of funding, which we can talk about, which is asset-based financing. You've got revenue-based financing. You've got contract financing. You've got factoring. You've got, I'm missing some stuff right now, but you've got a host of, there's lots of different things. Well, you got owner financing. That's the other king, right?
Right.
Is owner financing, right? You can do a deal where you're getting a little owner financing in there. I've even seen people do deals where they've gotten almost 100% owner financing. So that's the king of outside of getting that cheap SBA funding. So there are just so many different ways you can do a deal to where you can get access. One of the biggest things I learned from my training program out of is that you're only limited by your creativity. And I believe that to be true when it comes to also getting access to capital is you're only limited by your creativity in terms of finding the type of money that you need to do your deal. Because the other big one is private money, right? Is getting investors to do the deal with you rather than you trying to qualify for funding all on your own.
I was going to say, I took the same course you did. I've taken a couple of courses and I've interviewed all the gurus out there, all the guys, most of them anyway. I still interview them. I got a few of them coming back up again. That said, one of the things I learned in that process was like in the real estate world, you have to be careful of the thing called pooling, right? So you can get yourself run awry with the SEC if you take a little bit of money from this guy and a little bit of money from that guy, because now you've created a security, right?
Right.
So there's some rules around that. And there's still rules around that inside of this space, but I never thought about one of the guys in that training space calls a deal pie. But basically, you can raise the money for an acquisition of a business through multiple sources without running amok of the SEC. So you could look at all the equipment sitting on the floor and go, you know what, there's $6 million of the equipment. Somebody will give me, let's just be overly generous, a 60% loan on that, right? Maybe even a little bit more than that. But, you know, now I get that much money. Okay, now I've got $3 million in accounts receivable. I can get a little bit of a loan on that. And yep. Then, you know, I've got $5 million in recurring revenue on contract. Somebody will give me a little bit for that. Now I can bring in an investor. Now I needed X number of dollars. I'm $2 million short, right?
Yeah.
That now I have to just convince the owner on a major purchase to finance one of it, and I'll bring an outside investor in for one. And you still only have technically one individual that's not an institution mm-hmm. investing you. So you didn't pool funds like the SEC because they're only worried about you betraying or doing something wrong to an individual investors.
Yeah, absolutely.
I never even thought of that until I went to the course about you can mix and match these funding sources to get to the target.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the industry term that is capital stacking. People who want to sound like they know what they're talking about, right?
Yeah.
And stacking different types of capital so that you can get that and take that deal down. And it's just, but again, you're only limited by your creativity and when it comes to that.
I always thought this, you know, raising money through a private placement memorandum was a huge, complex issue. It's cost money. $25,000, $30,000 probably is the entry fee for that. And it goes up from there. But it's pretty much a business plan, a private placement memorandum, which is a fancier version of a business plan, a single one to two page filing with the SEC, and then regularly, I think it's either quarterly or annually reporting to them. It's not as complex as I thought it was. After interviewing a few people, I was thinking it's kind of akin to going public where you got to like fill out 1,000 forms with them and get background checks and all this weird stuff. It's not nearly as complex. Let's talk about the process. What do you, second to SBA loans, because we've had that on the show a lot. And you have, if somebody needs an SBA loan, they can come to you. You have people on your team that can help with that too, as part of their capital stack.
Right.
On the items outside of that and the items that are primarily non-personal guarantee items, because I don't think if you do an SBA loan, I don't think they're happy if you've got multiple personal guarantee loans off to the side of it. So it's either or, right?
Yep. Yeah. Cause I can't say what I want to say about that, but yeah, they make sure you heavily PG the loan.
Right. Mm-hmm, yeah.
With collateral and things like that. Yes.
They're not going to leave much PG laying around for somebody else to use anyway.
Yeah. Every PG they can find up from you, they're going to make sure they can encumber it to the deal. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that said, let's talk about what are the some requirements for some of the other, I don't know, let's just jump into one. A lot of companies that you're buying are brick and mortar. A lot of the companies, the people listening to this that are buying, are brick and mortar. And they have equipment, they have assets, they might have like forklifts and heavy machinery and manufacturing equipment and stuff. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? What is the loan process? What is a timeline? Walk me through, I'm buying a company that has $2 million worth of physical assets sitting on the floor. What do I need to do to get a loan against that?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the main things you need to do is you need to assess that equipment. Mm-hmm. So you got to get a list from the seller to that equipment with all the right information on it so that you can then have that list evaluated to determine what is actually worth. And then of course, based on that, how much can you get for it? Right. What can you borrow against it? Right. And then how are you going to do that? Whether you're going to do a sales lease back or whatever. And that time frame is usually pretty quick compared to the SBA, right? You might be looking at, 30, 45 days, typically, doing something like that. Same if you want to do like contract financing or something like that, you're probably due diligence process is probably about 30 days. Probably less, but generally around 2 weeks to 30 days, as long as that's after everything they need is into the underwriter, right? Let's see, what else?
What kind of things would they need, though? I mean, they get a sample of the contracts, right?
Yeah, they need a copy of the contract and all the details around the contract so that that satisfies the underwriter. And then they evaluate it to determine, hey, is it really worth what the face value of that contract is? And this is based on that, we'll give you this LTV on that particular contract, right? And it varies in terms of what the LTV is on that particular contract. The highest I've seen recently is about 65-70%. That's just me personally. There may be people who can do better or worse, but that's about what I have seen in that space. And then on the equipment side, probably between 50 and up, right? 50% and up on that, depending on who you talk to, because there are a lot of different lenders out there who do that.
I want to touch on one thing real quick, though, because if you're listening to this and you think, I'm going to use this to fund a business, you got to find something that's extremely profitable, because you're taking a business that's been around for 15, 20 years who hasn't had the burden of debt.
Right.
And now you're going to be making monthly payments. And I don't know what your interest rates you're seeing on the factoring for the accounts receivable and equipment. When I looked at it before, last time I looked at it deeply, it was before the interest rate shot up, and they were still charging considerable amount. I have a buddy from mine that used to be he still is a Rotarian. I had kids and didn't have enough time to stay part of Rotary International, but yeah. He's still a Rotarian, but he does that. He does equipment lease, sell leasebacks and loans against equipment and that type of stuff. But the rates are extremely high depending on the age of the equipment and the company itself, and the company's credit profile comes into play some, like their history and that type of stuff. But I would say the best rate he could get you is 18%, and it went from 21, 22, his credit card rates.
And you have to account for that, right, in your deals, be able to handle that debt service. And that's a really critical point for people who are looking to do an acquisition that you... Yes, you want to do what you can to take the acquisitions down. There are so many things you have to be forward thinking on to be successful after you have it after you take it over, right? And one of those is being able to handle that debt service. So, so important.
A lot of people look at these businesses and they're like, oh, the businesses, a lot of businesses out there this way. I just talked to a guy, his business is doing all right. When I asked him what his profit margin was, and it sounded impressive. He's like, oh, I'm doing $800,000 a year. I asked him what his profit margin was. He said 8%. I was like, 8%? And he's like, oh yeah, 8%. And I'm thinking 8% on 800,000 is not very much. $64,000 a year. That's
$100,000. Yeah, for sure. 70 or so.
That's so he's cranking out $800,000 a year. He's making his profit. Now he probably pays himself a salary. That's okay. But his profit is $64,000 a year. To buy his company, debt service, you know, if you needed to raise $800,000, it'd be really hard to look at, you know, your debt service on $800,000 at 18% would probably eat up every bit of that, right? So that's why I said you got to find companies that actually are extremely profitable, that they can handle this, and then you'll eat it for the first 2 or 3 years until you get that debt paid off. And then that's when you really start to make serious money. But you just got to make sure that there's some the room that, for the cushion. The other thing I would say before we get too far, I'm going to ask you about a bunch more loan products, is understand the business's cycle. Almost every business has have cash flow cycles, like hot seasons, cold seasons. A lot of them are extremely, anything B2C could be extremely fluctuating, maybe during between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So if you if you make a product that would typically be given away as a gift or something like that, then your prices are going to, I mean, your sales are going to be, 2/3 of your sales are going to be at the end of the year. So a lot of people don't get that and understand that they buy this business in January and cover it with debt. Yeah, the business made $3 million last year, but you're not going to get two of it until the end of the year. Now you still got to pay those loan payments all the way throughout the year. So just understand both what you're getting into when you're looking at these products, and don't think that this is super easy. I don't believe in get rich quick, and I don't believe in trying to portray anything that's super easy, but it is very doable. So let's talk about the other products that are out there. We did talk about asset-based loans. We talked about contract, that they would review the contracts and stuff. What else is available?
Oh, man. So you've got what's called non-recourse funding. I don't know. There's lots of different versions of that. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the way it works for those people who don't know is that your project funds the loan, essentially. And that takes out the PG, the personal guarantee, which is what people really want to avoid as much as possible when they're doing these deals, right? And there are sources out there to where you can get that non-recourse, but they're kind of hard to find. And then there are versions of that program that are out there that I recently have gotten access to where you can get some really sizable loans from those programs. And I'm looking at bringing one on board now, where it will go up to about $99 million. And we're still working on the finishing touches of that. But, and so you can get those loans and be able to take down those deals without having to be, and it's a lot easier, and the process is only about 90 days without all the PG and collateralizing that you would do with the SBA.
So one of the things that a lot of people miss in the banking world is particular banks have particular sweet spots, things that they do regularly. So if you go to your local bank, for instance, I live in the Redwood Forest of Northern California. There's just not a lot of manufacturing around here. So if I went to a local credit union and went to every local bank or regional bank in this area and said, hey, I'm buying a $2 million manufacturing business here in Sonoma County, most likely there may be one. We'd have to find the one that's comfortable doing that, because most of them, they'll advertise they do business loans and stuff, but what they're loaning on is what they're comfortable with because that's what's available to them. So it's the it's elder care, because this is the vineyard area. I'm surrounded in wine country. So a lot of people retire up here, right? And it's restaurants and bars and B2C type of businesses, retail, restaurants and bars. If you were going to open one of those, half the dozen of those regional banks and stuff would be able to have some product to help you do it. Do these non-recourse sources you have, the reason I told you the whole story was, do they have sweet spots? Do they have certain industries and stuff that they prefer? Often you won't know that until you look at whether the last 10 loans that they made, you'll say, wait a second, they say they'll loan to anything, but the last 10 loans they made were to industrial manufacturing.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, is that every funding source has their sweet spots, right? Mm-hmm. Whether, like you said, whether it's a local, regional, or national bank, even in some cases, and even if you go international, right? They have their sweet spots of things that they like to fund. Most people, most lenders stay away from the adult entertainment industry, for example. That's an easy one, right? But primarily, when you get into real acquisitions, there are sweet spots that they have. Like, for example, like you mentioned manufacturing, for example. But you can even get even more nuanced than that. You can get to where, hey, we're only looking for manufacturing in, say, the automotive space, right? Because they are from Michigan, right?
Right. Or they just know that space inside and out. They've had good success with it. They want to do more. It's just natural. Absolutely. Human. People forget all the time that all these businesses are run by human beings. Human beings actually have psychological biases. And yeah, they have two or three good wins inside of something, they'll gravitate towards what they know. They'll gravitate towards what they want out at the last three or four places. So how do you, like, for these non-recourse loans and stuff, what does the process look like? What are they evaluating? Are they evaluating the business the same way an SBA loan would do, where they see the financials of the business, they're looking at the merits of the business, or do they look at the individual that's wanting to do the loan?
So the program that I can't speak for all of them, but the program that I'm working with, it is far simpler than what you would do with the SBA. So the way this program is being structured, that you simply submit a one-page executive summary on your project. You sign an NDA, and then we get you on a call with all the folks so then you can ask and have your questions answered about, essentially it's a dual vetting process. And so there is and you simply have to be able to put down a deposit, refundable deposit, let me be clear, a refundable deposit for the program. So let's say that if your goal is you're looking to raise $5 million, you will put down 10% of that, which is $500,000.
Can you use this, what do they call them, surety bonds? I'm going to butcher the name. Is it a bonded?
Absolutely. That's how it's secured, right? Rather than you being securing it by your credit or any type of personal collateral. That's how the program works. And so then they do all their financial engineering on the back end, and then 90 days later, you get your $5 million plus your $500,000 back. And that is so much easier than what you're going to go through with the SBA to get $5 million or any brick and mortar bank that you're going to walk into and try to get $5 million. So, and your project is what, or qualifies, that's what I'm looking for, sorry, is what qualifies for the funding, right? Not so much you, the individual, and your credit and what assets you have personally.
Did they look at the operator? I mean, if you're doing an acquisition, because it's different. If I own the company, I've been running for 20 years, and I go in there and try to, or get some funding, there's a track record there. How do they evaluate the capabilities of the operator if it's an acquisition for these type of loans?
Sure. We have a team of evaluators that's what they do. That's all they do. Mm-hmm. And they will bet all of that, right? And that, yeah, we need to know what you're talking about. Obviously you do. You need to be skilled in that arena if you're going to take over that business and take it to wherever it needs to go in order to be able to pay back the loan. But it is it's more of a skill scrutiny versus a asset scrutiny. If that makes sense?
Am I saying that? The SBA wants to know you have some background in it, but they're more interested in what you can guarantee the loan with.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Right. Whereas we're, hey, can you really take over this business and take it to the next level? We're not so much concerned about you having all of the collateral to take care of this loan should things go sideways. No. Can you really run this business the way it needs to be run to cover this debt? And based on that, that's how you get funded.
If somebody's listening and they're fairly new, they say they've only had W-2 jobs all their life, they're wanting to go down this path, would it be better for them to go out and find a JV partner that's got some operational experience and some track record to get this type of loan, or does it matter?
It does. If they are starting from, like I said, they've never done this before, and let's say that they were in an administrative role. Mm-hmm. That's been their focus their entire career, right? And they're looking to do something. They're looking to start or go buy a business that is very different from that. Ideally, yeah, you'd want to go and find someone who has expertise in that space to partner with to get qualified for this funding. That would be the best way to do it. That way, you are set up you're much more better set up for success in doing what you're looking to do.
So I know in the SBA and a lot of other loan processes, and even some states, have rules around percentage of ownership. So it's 20% or more in most of these cases. So if somebody, say you have a JV partner, if somebody has 20% of stuff, they have to be brought in and vetted in a lot of these loan products. Is that true in what you're working with too? If somebody's a, if there's a threshold where they become a significant partner.
Yeah, and it varies, but yeah, it's usually around somewhere between 10 and 20% where they would be have to be vetted as well. What else I should say about that? But yeah, that's pretty much the case.
Yeah. The answer was, it was a yes or no question. It wasn't, you know, like, yeah, they still look at that. If somebody owns a significant portion, and it sounds like by loan products, significant portion is defined differently, 10-20%. Like, I know that I'm a partial owner on a few things, that projects that are out there, yeah, but I don't want to do any personal guarantees or anything. So I come in an advisory role and I stay underneath that 20% ownership realm, so that when right, they need to raise capital, if they decide to do an SBA loan, they don't have to, I don't have to sign any personal guarantees or anything. I'm going to stay out of that picture. So I was just curious if that held true, yeah, on the realm. Let's rank these things in financial viability, like easy. Let's do it first by ease to get, like what's the fastest way to get money. And then we'll redo the same question on who has the best rates. Like the SBA is probably going to beat everybody on rates, but SBA aside, let's start with, you know, I've got a business here. We need to close in 120 days. So that's pushing it. I've already done my due diligence. I think we're ready. And all of a sudden my funding source backed out. I need to raise money. Which source would you point them to first?
If they're in a situation, especially 120 days out, I would definitely try either. I would steer them toward either a non-recourse program like the one that we have, mm-hmm, or go toward private money. That would probably be the fastest way to get it done. And then you could refi out of that later or whatever. Those would probably be the top two for me. Just thinking off the top of my head, trying to think, is there anything else that I would add to that? Those are probably the top two.
A lot of people don't get that if you got a single investor, you can, the same process people go through and they go out and pitch family offices and wealthy individuals to raise money into a private placement memorandum or whatever. You can do the same thing and not have to go through SEC if it's a single source. So you can go to a family office and go, hey, I'm looking to buy this company. They call them independent sponsor. It's a form of independent sponsorship. Like, would you sponsor the purpose? And they get both a debt and an equity position. And usually the equity reduces after the debt's paid in full. So, I mean, you can structure the deal any way that you want to creatively do it. When you said private investor, it spurred up this conversation of what would that look like? It isn't your Uncle Joe's going to loan you $5 million, right? In the real estate game, private investor means anybody's got money can help me get this deal done.
Right.
In this space, you're still going to want an you're going to need an accredited investor, you know, with some deep pockets, that the number you're asking for isn't going to hurt them one way or the other. It's just they need a decent return on it. And they're going to charge you, most of these guys, to be honest, I'm surprised at how low the interest rate can be for some of the private equity guys and family offices and stuff.
Yeah.
They'll go lower than some of these institutional lending places will.
Yeah. So some of the things that I have seen, most of them are usually around 8 to 10%, sometimes 8%, 12.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's they're okay with that. Right. And, mm-hmm, I think that's awesome.
Best one I seen here recently, a guy got, that was just a lot, $15 million from a private family office. And the way it was working is they were buying a company. They got, for a $15 million acquisition price, they got a really good deal because they're paying 3.5x. They did it on a 5-year note they got 5 years to pay it back. And then that family office retains a 7.5% profit share. So they got a long-term income out of it. So, you know, it was a no-brainer for the guy because he didn't have any other ideas. That was just what he came up with.
Yeah.
But he pays the loan back, pays the debt back, and then the debt converted to a minority interest in it. So the guy, the family office, gets long-term income from it, and they love the idea. And here's a guy who bought a business. He knew the industry. He had worked in a competing company, tried to buy that competing company from its boss, and the boss was like, wasn't ready to retire. And to complete the story, the competitor heard that he was trying to do it, and he goes, "I'll sell you mine." Right. You know, you raise the money, I'll sell you mine. And then the next thing, I'm trying to get him on the show. I didn't say the name or anything because he hasn't agreed to be on the show because of NDA requirements and other stuff and he just completed this in December, January timeframe this year. So it's pretty early. It's closed, but it's one of those, he doesn't want to upset anybody because he still needs the old owners around and stuff because he don't want to talk about it too much.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're out there. The deals are out there. So I just wanted to cover that a little bit, that when you say private equity or private investor, it's not an individual. It's usually like a family office or somebody out there who has raised capital to play. There's even some private equity firms out there that are raising money now for people like us for acquisition. And it's a numbers game to find the right one.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't have a lot of those relationships, then you could get with a funder like myself or someone else that has those relationships. And then you're dealing with one source. And that way that can get you started faster rather than you have it, especially if you're not an extrovert, where you're going to get out there and not, and essentially knock on doors with some of these family offices and things like that and raise the capital that way. Yeah, absolutely, man. I think it's just so much opportunity out there. And I think one of the other things that I want to say about that when we start talking about private investors is that I don't think people really understand how much money is really out.
I just got my hands on a, I laugh because I got my hands on a list. I'm trying to get, I might make another round of this. I tried to get some family offices on the show. I think I've had two. I've had two and they were really kind of sheepishly what they would talk about on the show. But I cold called probably close to 1,000. I dialed probably close to 1,000 numbers, probably talked to 150 of them actually, because a lot of it just goes to voicemail. But, you know, I got a list from one of the gurus that says, like, here's all the private investors in the United States or family offices in the United States. And I hunted down their daggum phone number from various sources. I don't think the phone numbers are on the list, but they're easy enough to find. And I just start calling them. It's like, hey, I run a podcast about buying and selling companies. Do you mind if you, I ask you a few questions? I eventually would like to get you on the podcast, but right now I just want to, I'm curious. And some of the lessons I learned from them were most of them have more capital to deploy than I would have imagined to start with. More often than not, I was told that my audience and me, that's the reason they wouldn't come on the show too. My audience and what I was looking for was way too small for anything they're interested in, right?
Yes.
They're not interested in this SBA loan $5 million thing. I was told quite often that they don't deploy less than $50 million or $25 million. I think some of them said 25. Most of them were like, it takes the same amount of work for them to do a $50 million deal as it does to do a $2 or $5 million deal. The same amount of paperwork, same amount to them, the same amount of risk if they're sitting on a big enough office. And for anybody listening to this, don't know what a family office is. Once you hit a certain wealth, usually over $100 million, you'll hire an investment team that will manage the family trust, the family money. So family office is usually hereditary funds from multiple generations of family, and they'll, you know, in excess to $100 million. And they have people that are staffed. Sometimes it is a family member, but very often not. It's a financial advisor level guy whose whole job is to deploy the capital the safest and best route. That's why they'll give you loans for 6 or 8%. They're not looking for huge returns. They're looking for safe returns. They're looking for, you know, that business has been around for 30 years. It's going to be around for 30 more. Yeah, I'll loan money against it. You'll run it. You got to be careful. Some of them will put clauses in there that, you know, they have the potential they can replace you. Like they can tell you to step down as a CEO and bring in a different guy. Doesn't mean they can take your ownership away. Like all of us in the contract, you got to really read these contracts inside and out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would echo exactly what you're saying about the types of dollars they like to deploy, right? In fact, my non-recourse program, it is an incubator program for people who want to go up to 100 million plus. That's where they really make their money, right? And this program from 5 to 99 million is an incubator program. So it's designed to help you level up into that if that's where you're looking to go. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's where those folks who, that's where they have those relationships with those folks really want to deploy that 50, 100, 200 plus million dollars. The largest deal I've seen so far is 2 billion. I wasn't involved in that, but it would have been nice. And that blows a lot of people out of the water when you start talking those kinds of numbers, right? But yeah, for sure. When you have a serious conversation with those family offices, things like that, those are the type of numbers they're talking about. So you've got to really know what you're doing if you're going to be able to deploy that type of funding. And they want to see safe deals that they can put their money into and just get a nice return to continue to grow that family legacy.
Yeah, these family office guys, the manager of a family office will not lose his job if he gets a business. I talked to one guy, he just did a $50 million loan at 3%. I was like, why would you ever do that? He goes, ironclad business, it'll never go away. It's been around for generations. The CEO has been in there for 15 years, got 30 years before he retires. He's a young CEO. He's growing like mad, and it's safe money. He goes, I'll never lose my job by making 3%, 4%, 5% on the money. I'll lose my job if I lose money. As long as I won't lose money on it, you know, that's the one thing. Like, as long as I believe in the company. The other thing they've got to be careful with is, you said earlier, like adult entertainment stuff. They have to not discredit or they have to not embarrass the family office, the family name. So right. they're not going to do something if they find out that you're a gross polluter, or you drain chemicals into a national waterway or something like that. There's things like that that are both social. There's things that are economic and stuff that are be red flags for them. They won't touch because they don't want to make the family look bad. So
100%, absolutely. They do not want to be in the news or anything like that. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, just want to go their well quietly.
When I did those calls trying to get them on the show, I often thought, man, somebody could make a lot of money just sitting there creating a CRM, a database of all the different ones out there. What are they trying to deploy? What are their sweet spot? Because they want help. Hey, they'll pay finder's fees too. That would be a role for somebody. It's not for me because I just don't know the loan business that well. But somebody like you or something could get some serious cash from just reaching out to all the family offices and go, hey, if I helped you deploy cash, what would that look like? What would you want to invest in? What would you pay me as a finder's fee? And what would be the criteria to get you to say yes? Because I know people in this space.
Yeah, that definitely is a goal of mine. But I want to hire a team. I want to hire a team to do that legwork to make that happen, because that would be a very, very valuable tool coming into for people who are in this space when we talk about M&A. Because that's probably 80% of the work is doing the legwork of finding these family offices and other organizations that will lend, right? Because a lot of people, especially they're coming in this brand new, they don't even know where to start unless you're going to go pay some guru for however much money they charge to teach you where to start.
The two or three people I talked to recently, they did private placement memorandums and they raised... Like I just talked to one of Carl Allen's guys who raised $235 million. That was from institutional or a private, I don't know, private equity guys or whatever, family office type of guy. But, he walked in, gave a pitch guy, love the idea of what they're doing, and said, well, how much do you need? And he kind of got set back and he goes, $150 million. And like the guy laughed at him. He was like, yeah, it's not going to happen. Calls him back in a day or two and says, I'll do 110 or 120 or whatever the number was. But he says he's raised $235 million, but it's like two institutional investors that did it, right?
Yeah.
And it's all debt. So it's a debt structure. So he's not giving away equity in that position. They need to deploy it. He has a hell of a story to tell. They're backing his story. That's another thing, is like you have to have something that they want to get behind.
Absolutely. Especially if you can raise the money with just debt, right? And not have to give up any equity. That's awesome. That's a great place to be in.
So let's talk about, how do people reach out to you? What's the process to start working towards rate? When should they start the process? Let's start with that. When should they start the process of knowing where the funds is coming from?
Sorry, ask me that one more time. I'm sorry.
When should they start the process of knowing where they're getting the money for a deal? Like they went through a Roland Fraser, a Jeremy Harbor. They went through an ETA program at the local university, Stanford or Cambridge. All these schools now have these ETA, entrepreneurship through acquisition. They came out of the program. Maybe they don't want to raise a search fund through the traditional way. Maybe they didn't finish the college or whatever for reason. They're not going to use the in-house college-based search fund model, but they need to work. At what point should they kind of start looking at the different like sources of where the money's coming from?
In my opinion, yesterday.
Yeah.
Right. That's the short answer, right? Yeah, because you want to, obviously when you do an acquisition, right, the goal is to make money, right? Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's most important about that is how you take it down. That impacts your profitability, right? So you want to start that process, start learning what's possible for this particular deal as quickly as possible, even before you get to the point of signing an LOI. I have had people come to me when they've signed the LOI, and our due diligence period is 45 days. Okay. Make it hard for me, why don't you?
Yeah, and the other side of it is they don't understand. They just negotiated something that's not fundable, right?
Absolutely. Oh, gosh. Yes, absolutely. 100%. It's like, this deal doesn't make any sense. How I can't, there's nothing for me to do here. You gotta, if you're not savvy in that space, you definitely want to, if you can, get someone on your team or an advisor or something like that who can help you, because how is the money, the type of money, the rates and all that sort of stuff, all that matters in terms of how profitable your deal is going to be. It's so, so important, because on the other end, it's one of the things that, that a lot of people don't think about, and we can talk about this more if you want, is that is the funding for the growth aspect of the deal.
Right, right. So before we get to, let's do that in just a second here. Before we get to that, there's things, this question burning in my head. What is your typical terms for a non-recourse loan? Is it, what I mean by that is that what's an average interest rate and what's the average length of the term of the loan? Like, is it 15 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 2 years? What's the loan?
What I have seen is what's, it's usually very typical of what a, like a business term loans, for example, are usually 5 or 7 years typically. And you, the ones that I have seen, those not are usually follow along with that. The longest I have seen is 10 years. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have one that will go 10 years, and that 10-year term is at 6%. And in some cases, you can even do interest only in that period if you choose to.
I've seen some of these commercial, I'm leaning on my real estate experience, and this might be different in this space, but some of the commercial loans I've seen, they could be like a 10-year loan, but they have a 3-year review period, meaning that every 3 years throughout the loan, they're going to come in and look at the financials and they can call the loan due. I actually know of a gentleman right now who, it's been years ago, but he came to me one day and he's like, hey, they're going to take my business away if I don't come up with X number of dollars. And he owned a bunch of real, the reason he came to me is I bought real estate up like you wouldn't believe. And he had a notebook. He goes, here's 47 houses I own. I need to raise 300,000, you know, like in the next 30 days. Show me which houses you would buy for 300,000. And because he owned all of his properties free and clear. So he goes, just look through them and see, you know. And I was a little overzealous because his houses were in rough zones and in rough condition. So he never agreed to the number of houses. I basically wanted them all, but it wasn't going to happen. And then I cut it back down to about 10 or so. And this is Oklahoma, where it's not uncommon to get houses in those areas for 10 or 20 grand, 30 grand. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah. I came up with, hey, I'll take these 12. And he still said no, but he found another way. But the reason he was in trouble is the economy had changed on him a little bit. And they did one of his evals, like every 3 years, his commercial loan had to be reevaluated. Is that something that happens in some of these other commercial products? They're going to look at your financials and your business. They're going to do a health check on the business every so often to make sure that you're still on track?
Yeah, it definitely can. Absolutely. And it obviously it varies from lender to lender. But yeah, absolutely. They want to look at that. But you have those lenders as well who, hey, as long as you're making a note payment on time, we're good. Now, if you miss one, that might trigger that, right?
Right.
If you're late on one, that might trigger that, right? You don't want to get into that situation, but absolutely. When you start looking at those folks who want to make sure that their investment is doing what it's supposed to be doing, yeah, they want to make sure you're doing, holding up your end of the bargain, if you will, and making this deal earn me my ROI.
You brought up an important part. Let's talk about it real quick. When you raise capital to purchase a company, you need to do more than just raise to do the acquisition itself, right? When you acquire something, day one, you pay the seller off, but there's operational costs, there's costs to do certain growth avenues and stuff like that. Especially when you just took on debt, the fastest way to make it do some easing on you is you grow the company, right? You buy a company doing $5 million a year and $1 million in EBITDA, and now you got debt coverage that's eating that $1 million a year up. Fastest way to ease that is to, let's grow it to 1.5 million and now we're a little more comfortable. Growth very often takes capital. What is your recommendation on raising enough money to fund the growth?
Well, first I would say you definitely have to have that plan going in.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, okay, if I'm at 1 million right now, what do I need to do to grow it to that 1.5 where I will be comfortable? And then whether that's marketing or whatever, what is that going to cost realistically? And you know that number, right? So that when you have a plan for that and you have a number for it, and then obviously you execute that the right way, because some people just abandon their plan. That's a whole other conversation. And so you know that going in, right? That's part of your acquisition strategy, is that, and you know that when you're looking for capital as well. So you let you're letting your lenders know, look, this is what it's going to cost to acquire it, and this is what's going to cost to grow it. And you can get that all of that funding in one place, right? That would be ideal, right? But if not, then you can capital stack to where you can also get that growth funding. But ideally, you want to have that going in before you even sign the LOI. You know what it's going to take to grow that company and what it's going to cost you. Yeah. That's my thoughts on that.
It's interesting. If you plan ahead of time, you build that into your capital stack, right? You just know that, the guy wants $1 million for the company. It's got dated equipment. I'm going to need some money to refresh some equipment. It's got no marketing. I'm going to need X number of dollars to institute a decent marketing plan and put some ads out there. And then it's got outdated this and that, and I'm going to replace that. That should be part of the overall capital stack, the money you're raising ahead of time. I see too many people like just try to get to the number that the seller wants and not understand what's your plan afterwards. And it's a lot harder to raise the money afterwards. You own this thing. Now you're a new owner on day one. Don't think you're going to run to a bank on day one and go, hey, I just bought this company and now I need some new equipment. You just bought a company.
Another great point. It's like it's a brand new company, right? When it changes ownership, you're at zero. And so I've even had to help clients with that. And the funding that's available at that point is a lot of very expensive money. Mm-hmm. When it comes to you being
green and the equipment asset, all this, MCA, you can do a little bit of hand. The things you can do beforehand, a lot of those you can do afterwards, but you just lost your leverage point because you don't have to take the money. You don't have to buy the company. You walk in there and go, I'm going to shut down if I don't get some money in my hands. They're going to do what they need to do to get it. They're going to take that risk on you most likely, but they're going to charge you for it.
Absolutely. 100%. 100%.
Yeah. It's nothing like a lot of people think, let's equate it to something everybody deals with. And if you go out and buy a car and you're like, I buy this car and then suddenly I want to do a bunch of mods to it. And you go right back to the bank the next day you bought the car to a different bank. And go, hey, I just bought a car yesterday for 50 grand. I'd like to add $15,000 of the parts on there. Yeah. Would you loan me $15,000 to loan like that? And they're going to go, that's the car's the collateral for the last guy. What do I have? And I don't get that, right? People don't
That's
get
an awesome analogy. Absolutely. That's an awesome analogy. Yeah. Very
so
true.
You got to plan ahead on these things. You got to be ready. What do we need to do to get a hold of you? What's the best way to sit down and go, hey, Parnell, I'm looking to acquire this type of company in the next 2 years. Help me walk through this. Do you have any checklists that people can have or anything like that? Or they can just reach out and chat with you and start building that relationship with you to know where they need to be to get funded?
Yes, there's a lot of who. But before you even come to me, let's go down that list. One, ideally you'd have some acquisition where they've been using a reliable financial software, which means that they have also some solid financial reports on the company. Ideally you'd be looking at, you want to be looking somewhere between 3 to 5 years for the financially, if you can. I know a lot of cases you probably only get two, right? And that's fine, but ideally you don't want to be able to get 3 to 5. Then you kind of really can gauge the health of the company, right? And we talk about financials. For those people who don't know, we're talking about income statements, balance sheets, cash flow statements. And then ideally you want to get those on an accrual basis rather than a cash basis. And that's an accounting thing for people who don't know. You want to get those financials on an accrual accounting basis if you can. Make sure the book's balanced. Make sure the equity actually equals assets minus liabilities. And ideally, if you can, have those financials reviewed, if not audited. Those are some of the things that it would be good to have coming to me when you start looking for funding, because that makes you more fundable. It makes your project more fundable, right?
So you're saying a quality of earnings report makes it easier for you to get funded?
In a lot of cases, yes.
Okay. Most people don't pull the trigger on that unless it's a much bigger acquisition, though. Right, because they can be $15,000 to $30,000 to get a quality of earnings, a QOE.
Yes, unless you can have an evaluator that can pull that together for you, that you can have on your team to give a little bit of equity. You may not have to pay that up front. I've seen that happen. Those can be expensive. And then after that, then you simply set an appointment with me, and we'll go through your deal and see, and then we'll look at what's the best type of funding for you. and we'll go after it. We go get it.
Okay. And what's the best way for people to reach out to you? Is there a LinkedIn email address or a phone number you want people to call? How do you want people to reach out to you?
Yeah, the best way to reach out to me is definitely on LinkedIn, my LinkedIn profile. Just look up my name, Parnell Speed. And then, of course, you can always email me at parnell@rbhcapital.com. That's a great way to reach out to me. Yeah, let's do that.
That's cool. And then one thing, we always like to end up with a key takeaway. So to end the show today, if somebody can only remember one or two things about what we talked about raising money to buy the company, what would you want them to remember?
Great question. I know it may sound cliche, but it is the thing I want them to know is that it's doable. It's not as daunting as you might think if you educate yourself and you work with the right people. I think that's it. If you're not seasoned in that yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Is to work with people who are going to have your best interest at heart. It's very doable.
Okay. And I appreciate you today. Hold on for just a second afterwards, and we'll call that a show.
All right. Sounds good.
Awesome. Thank you. I want to announce our new channel partners, the ITX Marketplace. Since 1998, ITX has created $5 billion in value by selling more than 225 IT businesses in 20 countries. ITX works exclusively with IT-enabled businesses generating between $5 million and $30 million who are ready to be sold, and M&A decision makers who are ready to buy. For over 25 years, ITX has developed industry knowledge that helps determine whether a seller is a good fit for their buyers before making the match. ITX Mergers and Acquisition Marketplace, we have partnered with, has a proprietary database of 50,000 plus global buyers seeking IT service firms, managed service providers, Microsoft service providers, software as a service platforms, and channel partners with Microsoft, Oracle, ServiceNow, and the Salesforce space. If you have an IT-enabled business, you're ready to sell, I want you to visit the itexchangenet.com/marketplace. How to exit. That link will be in the show notes. Visit them now.